right. Well, thanks for your patience. Well, welcome to Tech Days. I assume you've probably been here all day. I hope you've attended some great sessions so far. My name is Jeff Procise, and I'll be your presenter for the next 75 minutes. And just to make sure you're in the right place, and that I am too, this session is titled HTML5, The Good, the Bad, and Everything in Between. Now, that sort of implies that maybe everything is not all goodness. Let me tell you just a bit about why I put this session together. My professional life today involves writing lots of code. My passion is writing native code. I love writing Windows Store apps. I love writing Windows Phone apps. But I do a lot of work in HTML5 as well, building apps for customers, seeing what kinds of problems customers are having. And one thing that I found in talking to customers, not only in the U.S. but elsewhere also, is that there's a lot of perception out there about HTML5 that sometimes isn't too accurate. Yes, there are some fantastic things about HTML5. There are some things that maybe aren't so fantastic as well. What I'm going to do in this session is run through the features of HTML5 that are either ready for use today or that are getting very, very close to being ready. I'm not going to show you a lot of slides. Most of the work we're going to do is going to be in Visual Studio. I'm going to be showing you lots of code, lots of samples, explaining why I think certain things are good and certain things aren't so good about HTML5. In fact, one of the things I'm going to do is give each feature a grade. Now, in the United States, when our kids are going through school, they receive letter grades A through F. I'm going to grade features of HTML5 A through F as well. Most of the grades are pretty good, as you'll see, but some of those aren't so good. We may need to send those kids back to school. But realize that when I assign these letter grades to features, it's just my opinion. I'm sure you could talk to someone else who may have a different opinion. Before I start looking at code, however, there is something I want to show you. I'm going to be showing lots and lots and lots of samples, and it occurred to me that you may want a copy of these samples for yourself. This link here to a file on my SkyDrive contains a copy of all of the samples that I'll be showing you, plus a whole lot more that I won't be showing you. What you'll find at that URL is a zip file containing a Visual Studio 2012 solution named HTML5 Demos. Again, it will be the basis for the demos that I do. You're welcome to take that code, to use it for yourself, to share it with your colleagues, to do whatever you want to do with it, and I'll make sure that that URL is active for some time after the conference in case you don't get around to downloading it until you get back to work. So, and I'll bring this back up at the end of the session as well, but with that, let's start talking about what's good and what's bad about HTML5. And I want to start off with a feature that flies under the radar sometimes, but one that I think they've done very, very well. It's useful to you if you build single-page web applications, SPAs, or more generically, if you build any web apps that use AJAX to load content, but you want to give the user the ability to use the back button to step back through the different states of that page. The History API allows you to do that. Now, browsers have, for years, given us browser-specific APIs for interacting with the browser's history stack. But it has only been recently, and this is a fairly recent addition to the HTML5 family of features, that we've had a standard way to do this in any HTML5 browser. There is much, much more good about this feature than there is bad. That's why I give it an A-. I would give it an A or an A+ if it gave us a little bit more freedom to modify the back stack. It gives us only limited ability to do that. But in terms of solving the primary problem, which is how do apps that are SPAs or that are loading content through AJAX provide the same experience to the user as if the user were stepping through different discrete pages, this API does a very good job of doing that. By the way, another thing you'll see on each of these slides for each feature I present is a chart at the bottom that shows you which versions of which popular browsers today implement this feature. So for this History API, for example, which I'll demonstrate in IE10, you can clearly see that it would not work in IE9. You wouldn't expect it to work there because it wasn't implemented in IE9. With that, let's take a look. And there are actually two pages I want to show you, to show you what the History API is all about, in case you haven't seen it before. Here is the first of those pages. It's a simple HTML5 page with some interactivity built into it. It does load its content through Ajax. These are all fictitious headlines that you see right here, by the way. And as I click around in these items on the left nav bar, what I'm doing is using Ajax to go load fresh article content from a server and show that to the user. So I can click around on these links over here and load content time and time again. But I want you to notice that as I do that, nothing is changing in the browser's address bar. We have no deep linking support in this app. If the user is using the site, find an article they want to share with a friend, and they simply take that URL in the browser's address bar and email it off, well, when that user, that friend, pulls this site up, they're going to be looking at the default page for the app. Worse, you can see that there is no back button support here. Now, had I actually been navigating from page to page to page, the browser's back button would have lit up, and I could have clicked the back button to go back to the previous article. But because this is a canonical single-page app, and I'm simply loading that fresh content with Ajax, the browser sees no navigation events happening. Therefore, it doesn't even enable the back button. Now, let me show you a separate version of this page that does use HTML5's History API. This page is named historydemo.html. It looks the same on the outside. And as I click around, I see the same articles that I saw the previous time. But I want you to notice that now the browser's back button has become enabled. And, in fact, each time I click, you see a change occurring in the browser's address bar so that users do have the option of deep linking these articles. Now, to demonstrate that the back button is working and that I'm not just lighting it up to fool you, I'll click back and I'll step back through this. So with the History API, I can provide the same experience to a user in a single page app or any app that loads this content through Ajax that they would receive had I navigated them from page to page to page as they use this application. Now, let me show you what this looks like. And the cool thing is, this API is simple. It didn't take a lot of work in code to add that functionality to the app. The very first thing that I do when this page fires up in the browser is see if the browser I'm running in even supports the History API. This is the standard and agreed upon way that we typically do that. This way, I can know not to even try to access the browser's history and light up that back button if the browser that I'm running in doesn't support it. Now, let me show you the code that executes when I click one of those links in the left nav bar. That's down here. I'm using jQuery to find all of those HTML anchor elements that are my left nav links. Those are just anchor elements, by the way, that I've stylized with CSS to look like a left nav bar. And I'm using jQuery to wire a click handler to each of them, so when any one of those links is clicked, this code down here executes. It's actually this call right here, using jQuery's load method that loads the fresh content through Ajax. But here's the key to lighting up the back button. Once more, I make sure that this browser does support the History API. If it does, then I do this. In a browser that supports this API, History is a new property hanging off of the window object. Through that History property, I can call a method named pushState to push an item onto the browser's backstack. The same thing that happens effectively when the user physically navigates from one page to another. You can see that I pass three parameters to that pushState method. The first one is anything I want it to be, anything that I will need to recreate the state of this page as it was at the moment I made this call if the user clicks the back button to go back to that page in that state. The second parameter is a string. No browser currently uses it today, so I just passed in null. And the third is the URL that corresponds to this node that I'm adding to the browser's history stack. This is how I modify what appears in the browser's address bar so that the user enjoys deep linking support. Now, believe it or not, that's one half of the History API. This is each time the user clicks one of those left nav links to show fresh content, lighting up the back button by pushing a new entry onto the history stack. But that alone won't produce the effect that you saw just a moment ago. To complete the equation, what I have to do is this. I have to register a handler for the new popState event that fires from browsers that support the History API if and when the user clicks the back button. When that happens, because the browser doesn't really know what the previous state of the page looked like or the state before that, it passes to me through the state property of the event args that's passed in whatever I passed in the first value to push state when I pushed this history node onto the stack. All I'm really pushing in this example is a string that I include in the command that I fire off to a web service to get the content. In other words, that string is all that I needed in order to recreate the state of this page. Since that first parameter to push state can be anything you want, even a very complex JavaScript object, you can literally push there whatever you need to recreate the state of the page and access it when that pop state event fires through the state property. So what I'm doing in reaction to that, when the user clicks the back button, I go grab that string that I passed to push state from the browser, and then I call jQuery's load method to go reload that content from the server. A few lines of code, 5 or 6 lines of code total, and I have an application that is going to be much, much more compelling in the hands of a user. And that is why the History API was added to HTML5. You can see it's a simple API, it works very well, and that's why I decided to give it an A-. Now, what about this? Geolocation. There are a lot of apps out there in the world today that are location aware. In fact, I'm astonished that more of them aren't. There's a popular app in the States, it's probably popular here too, called Urban Spoon. Runs on Windows 8, runs on iPhones and things like that. When you're traveling, it uses the location API to find out where on the planet you are, and then it recommends restaurants and other things in the area. The cool thing is, it's easy to build HTML5 apps that are location aware too. Through the geolocation API, which has been in HTML5 for a while, and as you can see here, is widely supported, not only in desktop browsers, but in mobile browsers as well, I could easily build something like Urban Spoon in HTML5 today. This is a very simple API. It's easy to learn. There are very few downsides to it. The reason I give it an A- and not an A is one thing. There are two methods that lie at the core of this API. One is called getCurrentPosition, which just gives you a one-time read on the user's current location. The data can come from GPS, if GPS is available, or it can come from other sources like Wi-Fi positioning or cell tower triangulation, if this is a device with cellular radio hardware. There's another method named watch position, which you could use to build real-time navigation apps that show turn-by-turn directions and show the user's current location as they drive down the freeway. That works in HTML5, but HTML5 gives you no control over the callback frequency. In most mobile operating systems, Windows Phone being one example, when you use its equivalent of watch position, it gives you a property named movement threshold, which is a value expressed in meters. It lets you tell Windows Phone, call me back each time the user's position is changed by 1 meter, or by 10 meters, or by 20. That allows us, if we're running on a mobile device that's running on battery power, since GPS receivers tend to drain battery power pretty precipitously, that allows us to be smarter in how often we get those callbacks and service that location data. In HTML5's location API, there is no ability to control that. You basically have to trust the browser to let you know that the user's position has changed when the browser sees fit to do that. Ignoring that minor nit, this is a very well thought out and very well implemented API. Now, you never know what's going to happen when I demo the location API in Europe. Hopefully this is going to work, but I didn't try this beforehand just to make this interesting. Let me show you a quick application, should be in my location folder, that combines HTML5's location API with Bing Maps to show where we currently are on a Bing map. So we'll run this thing here, we'll cross our fingers just a bit, and you can see IE here asking me if I'm okay as a user with it divulging my physical location. Obviously, that's a privacy issue. I'll click Allow once. Now, the browser is trying to determine where I am, and it looks like it's done a pretty good job, assuming these are the train tracks right outside. In fact, that it's done a very, very good job there. Now, here's the cool thing. I don't have a GPS receiver in this laptop that I'm running on. I don't have cellular radio hardware either. The only possible place that the data could have come from, the positional data, is through Wi-Fi positioning. If you've never been exposed to Wi-Fi positioning before, it is the black art. And I say black art because it's It's science inside, but it doesn't feel like science on the outside, of converting an IP address into a latitude and a longitude. There are several large companies in the world today, including Microsoft, Google, and others, that maintain very sophisticated Wi-Fi positioning services, and they do all sorts of interesting things to try to make this data as accurate as it can possibly be. You can see in this example, with nothing more than the IP address of the router that I'm connected to, IE has a pretty good idea where I am. Now, IE happens to rely on Microsoft's own Wi-Fi positioning service. And by the way, that data is obviously accurate enough, plenty accurate enough, to build an application like Urban Spoon in HTML5. But if I were to run the same thing in Chrome, I may get different results because Chrome doesn't rely on Microsoft's Wi-Fi positioning service. Instead, it relies on Google's. Let's see how good Google is at knowing where I am right now. So maybe even more accurate. That's a little scary, isn't it? That Google and Microsoft know where you are all the time as long as you're connected on some device to a router. So I get slightly different results, but you can see here that both Microsoft and Google have done a very good job. And with this location API, it's almost trivial to build this type of application. Let me give you a quick look inside this so you can see what's going on. Right here, when this thing starts up, when this page loads into the browser, here I'm creating a Bing map. By the way, see this big long string right here? I put this in here because I trust you. Now, here's what that means. Before you can build an app that uses Bing Maps, you have to go to Bing Maps' website and register to get a free API key. Then you transmit that key in every call you make up to Bing's mapping services so that they have some idea who's making the calls, that no one's abusing the service, and things like that. Normally, a speaker will not put his API key in the samples he gives out to you, but because I trust you, I know you're all good people, yes, my API key is in the sample. I would ask you, if you're going to use this location API in conjunction with Bing Maps, please go get your own API key, okay? Remember, through the Wi-Fi positioning service, I know where you are all the time. If you use my key, I'll come after you. So I create the Bing map there, but here's the HTML5 location API at work. In an HTML5 browser, I can call navigator.geolocation.getCurrentPosition. That is an asynchronous call, a request to get from the browser my latitude, longitude, perhaps other information as well. It turns out if the data is coming from GPS, you can also get an altitude as well as a few other things. Since the data is coming through Wi-Fi positioning, I feel pretty certain there's no altitude available here. When you call getCurrentPosition, there are actually three parameters that it accepts. The first is a success callback function, which the browser will call if it's able to determine where you are and, when prompted, the user okays the divulging of that information. The second parameter is probably more important. It is an error function. Had something gone wrong, had the browser simply been unable to determine where I am, or had the user said no when prompted, then the error function would have been called instead. The third parameter, by the way, is something called an options object, which allows you to provide additional options or specify additional options into your calls into the location API. One of the reasons that that's useful to developers is, for example, because GPS receivers do tend to be consumptive of battery power and mobile devices, most browsers in the world today, especially those that run on mobile operating systems, will never by default give you GPS information. You have to tell the browser through an options object in the third parameter to get current position that you want GPS data if it's available. In this case, it wasn't an issue since I don't have GPS hardware on this laptop anyway. That is an asynchronous call, remember. In this case, it obviously succeeded. Here's what my success callback looks like. Two of the pieces of information that you have access to when the success callback comes are the user's current latitude and longitude. Even though I haven't shown it here, there's also a parameter named accuracy, which is a value expressed in meters telling you how accurate the browser thinks the data is. When you're getting data from GPS, that accuracy value will typically be very small, 3, maybe 5 or 7 meters at most. When the data is coming from Wi-Fi positioning, it's typically on the order of anywhere from 5 meters up to several thousand meters, depending on how confident the Wi-Fi positioning service that the browser consulted is. We're not checking the accuracy value here, But since we've seen that the data is accurate, I'm pretty sure that the accuracy value would express a high degree of confidence in that. By the way, once I have that latitude and longitude, I wrap a Microsoft.maps.location object around that. That's not HTML5, that's Bing Maps. And then tell the map to center itself up there, setting the zoom level at the same time. Another thing you can do with Bing Maps, if you're interested, to make this kind of app richer, is add push pins to the map programmatically. If you were building something like Urban Spoon, for example, you may want to add push pins to the map representing restaurants, theaters, and things like that. What I'm doing in this example is just adding one push pin to the map representing the user's current location. Very simple API, very well implemented, designed to abstract where the data is actually coming from, and perfectly adequate even when the data is coming from Wi-Fi positioning for building location-aware apps. That is geolocation in HTML5. Now, what's next? Next is audio and video. I think if you walk up to someone in the street and say, tell me what you know about HTML5. One of the things they will tell you is, well, I've heard it supports audio and video natively. And that is absolutely true. We no longer need a Silverlight plugin or a Flash plugin or anything else like that to host audio and video natively in a web page. Now we can use the new video and audio elements. For the most part, they work and they work really well. In fact, I'm going to show you a video played using HTML5 video in just a moment. And yet you can see that when asked to grade this feature, I give it a B-. Let me explain myself just a bit right there. You would think that perhaps if a committee were going to come up with a standard for audio and video in HTML5, they might settle upon a standard set of audio and video codecs so that you could encode, say, a video file in one format and any HTML5 browser in the world could play it. Did you know that they were unable to do that? For various reasons, certain vendors who had a seat on the committee, for example, very much wanted to see file formats like MP4 supported, in part because chips for decoding those file formats are readily available and relatively inexpensive on mobile devices. One of the problems, however, is the codecs used in a typical MP4 file are not royalty-free. Companies like Google and Microsoft pay millions of dollars for the right to include support for MP4 audio, video in their operating systems, in their browsers. So what ended up happening is the committee members could not agree. And if you want to host HTML5 audio or video on your website using these features, you have to encode an audio file or a video file at least twice in two different, completely different formats, and then structure your audio or video tag such that different browsers can find the files that they support. It's minor in the grand scheme of things, but it is disappointing in that you have to find tools to do the transcoding into other formats and things like that. Now, let me show you a quick example of HTML5 video at work if you've never seen it, and show you how you have to multiply encode it and point browsers to that. Now, to do that, I'm going to play a little video here. It does have audio as well, and it's going to take just a moment probably for IIS to spin up and start serving the data down. And I hope this doesn't blare, but I do want you to hear the music. Let's give IIS a few seconds to wake up. Hasn't had its morning coffee, obviously, but it should be up here in a moment. And let me tell you a bit about the video that you're going to see. If you've ever attended my conference sessions before, you may know that I have a rather unusual hobby. I build and fly large radio-controlled jets, and I often find ways to work these jets, these machines, into the presentations that I do. Now, this video is of the second most recent jet I've built. It's a 1/6 scale American F-16 fighter. Now, 1/6 scale is about the size of a small car. In fact, it's bigger than some of the cars in Europe, come to think of it. About the size of a small car in the U.S. It's got a real jet engine, burns real jet fuel. In fact, one of my big challenges today isn't staying on top of things like HTML5. It's figuring out where to buy jet fuel. Because in the U.S. these days, if you walk up to an airport with a 5-gallon blue kerosene container and say, yes, I would like to buy 5 gallons of jet fuel, you end up on the Homeland Security terrorism watch list. And I like to stay off that watch list, so I've learned to make jet fuel myself. Now, I thought about putting a slide together on how to make jet fuel. I did not do that. That might get me into trouble as well. But if you really want to know how to do it, shoot me an email or see me afterwards. I'll tell you exactly how to make jet fuel. I'll tell you this. You need to like the smell of it if you're going to make it. I mix it in my basement at home, and the whole house smells like jet fuel for a couple of weeks afterwards. Now, I like that smell. I like it better than the smell of coffee in the morning, but my wife doesn't like that smell. So I try to be very careful. Let's see if HTML5 video can show this F-16 taking off. I'll take it full screen here momentarily. I'll let it play for just a few more seconds so we can see the takeoff. I love seeing these things take off. All right, if that doesn't get you excited about HTML5 video, I don't know what will. By the way, I'll tell you something not a lot of people know. When we build these jets, we go to a lot of time and trouble to try to make them look as realistic as possible, duplicating all the markings, the panel lines, and everything on the original jet. One of the challenges I had on this one was finding a pilot figure to put in the cockpit. Since it's a 1/6 scale jet, I needed a doll exactly 1 foot tall that looks really mean, looks like a real fighter pilot, real flight suit. I was able to find one. That is a George W. Bush action figure sitting in the cockpit of that jet. So you can feel safer knowing he's patrolling the skies overhead armed with Sidewinder missiles out on the wings. Now, let me show you real quickly what it took to host that video natively in the web page, and it was very simple. Here is the video element that caused it to appear. Because I have a controls attribute on it, I'm telling the browser to provide a playback UI for starting, stopping, going full screen, and stuff like that. If you wanted to build a custom playback UI, you could omit the controls attribute and use the API surrounding the audio and video elements as a basis for your own UI. Notice that I have two child elements of type source. I wanted to make sure this video would play in any browser. The MP4 file that was playing inside IE10 there is one of the options that I provided. But had you played this in a browser like Opera or Firefox, neither of which supports the MP4 file format, they would have only been able to play it if I gave them access to an OGV file like the one you see at the second one there. So this will work, and you can try this on your machine at home if you have Firefox or Opera, but you can also demonstrate if you were to remove or comment out this source element right here, that is now going to restrict it to the mainstream browsers like IE, Chrome, and Safari. Now, there's more I could say about audio and video, but I wanted to show you what it looked like in real life and also explain a bit about why I downgraded it just a bit when assigning a score to it. So with that, let's get back and talk about more features of HTML5. One of the questions that I'm frequently asked about audio and video support in HTML5 is it possible to take a video full screen? Well, the short answer is it depends on what browser you're in. You notice I took that video full screen. The only reason I was able to do that is because IE's default playback UI for a native HTML5 video element includes that full screen button. There is no way in HTML5 through the video API, however, to programmatically control that, to make a video go full screen or back to normal size. However, the HTML5 committees heard this request, and they have relatively recently added to HTML5 a brand new feature, which isn't widely implemented yet, but is coming to be widely implemented. It's called the full screen API. It's very cool. It allows you to take any DOM element, whether it's a video element or anything else, and take it full screen. It basically takes all the browser Chrome away. It hides any DOM elements that happen to lie outside of the DOM element that you took to full screen. And you could use this quite easily to programmatically make a video element go full screen, but you could use it with others as well. Let me show you something real quickly here. Just one quick example, and since this isn't supported in IE yet, I'll have to do this in Chrome, but that's not a big deal. Let's go into my full screen folder and find a page named fullscreendemo.html. First thing we'll learn when we run it here or launch it inside IE 10 is that this API isn't supported there, so I'll need to run it somewhere else, and we will use Chrome to do that. So let's fire up Chrome, paste that URL in, and now when I click this element, which is actually an HTML5 canvas element, I'm executing a single line of code that takes that element full screen. You'll notice that the browser Chrome is gone. Everything that might have appeared around that is gone as well. Again, this API was actually designed to work not just with video elements, but with any DOM element that you wanted to work with. Maybe a stumbling block that it's not implemented in IE yet, but I wouldn't be surprised to see it become implemented in IE pretty soon. So with that, let me press escape to get back out of full screen mode, and let's go talk about something that is potentially impactful to every HTML5 developer today. And that is the Canvas API, arguably the richest and most important feature of HTML5. The Canvas API allows you to draw into a browser window from JavaScript. Now, there have been ways to do this in the past with things like SVG, but there hasn't been a standard way to do it that works in just about any browser in the world. This does work in any HTML5 browser. Because it allows us to draw to the page from JavaScript, it allows us to build types of apps that we wouldn't have been able to do before. Suppose you wanted to build an app that simply went to the server, got some data, and then showed the user a nice pretty chart or a graph. In the past, what you might have done is generated an image of that chart or graph on the server to download to the browser. But then, if you wanted to make that graph interactive, allow the user to roll over bars in a bar chart or something to see additional data, it would have been a lot more difficult to do. In the heyday of HTML5, the way I would probably choose to implement that type of page is to have it send a little AJAX call out to a server somewhere to get the data, bring the data back, probably as JSON, and then use the Canvas API to generate that chart or graph on the client side. Now, that's just one use case for the Canvas API. I've ranked it or graded it an A- because it's so much better than anything JavaScript developers have had before. It's rich in that it allows you to draw almost anything you can think of. It supports mathematical paths. It supports transforms just like XAML does. So if you want to do scaling, rotation, translation, all of the same transforms you may be familiar with from XAML are supported here as well. My only criticism of it is that it is, by today's standards, a fairly primitive API. 20 years ago, this API would have been cutting edge. It has methods for drawing lines and drawing shapes and things like that. Most of us today who work in graphics are accustomed to retained mode graphic subsystems. We've used Direct3D or XNA or OpenGL or something else. This API isn't nearly as rich and sophisticated as that. But again, when you compare it to what we had before, which was essentially nothing, it is arguably the most important feature of HTML5. Now, to demonstrate that, I'd like to show you a few examples. I have many, many Canvas examples here. I won't show them all because I don't want to shortchange the other features we'll look at, but let's take a look at a few. And I'll start with this one right here, which does nothing more than use the Canvas API to draw the chart that you see. Now here, I'm just hard-coding the data in. I'm not making a call out to a service or anything to get the data. But if you've never seen Canvas before and you want to see what the API looks like, this is a pretty good place to start. Let me just show you a couple of things that I'm doing here, a couple of the basics of drawing with a canvas that are important to know about. Number one, Any application that uses HTML5's Canvas API begins with a Canvas element. You're not limited to one. I'm going to show you an example in a moment of a page that has lots of canvases in it. But you have to have at least one, because that Canvas element is the part of the page that you can draw to using the Canvas API. By the way, let me tell you a couple of things you should know that aren't docked very well, but are very annoying and time-consuming to overcome if you're not aware of it. Number one, Canvas is not an element that you can close off using the simplified syntax, the forward slash, and the greater than sign. A Canvas element needs to have an explicit closing tag, like I've done here. The funny thing is, if you forget that, as I've done a time or two, it will work sometimes, and sometimes it won't. The application may behave fine at first, and because of something else you're doing in that page, all of a sudden the things you draw just get all stretched or scaled for no apparent reason. Go back and make sure that your canvas has an explicit closing tag. Number two, never use CSS to dimension an HTML5 canvas. If you want to dimension that canvas, use explicit width and height attributes on the canvas element, as I'm doing here. Otherwise, again, sometimes it will work, sometimes it will not. And when it stops working, it will happen at the worst moment possible when you're showing it to the customer for the first time or something like that. So here's my canvas. But here's the code that does the drawing. Now, just a couple of highlights. Here, I'm asking the browser for a reference to that canvas element. I do that so that I can call a canvas method named getContext. In order to draw to a canvas, I have to have a reference to an object of type, canvasRenderingContext2D. That object, which we often call simply the context object for short, has about 20 properties and about 20 or 25 methods in it that actually are the Canvas API. The methods allow you to draw things to the screen, pixels, shapes, lines, shadows, things like that. The properties control the visual attributes of what you draw with those methods. So as an example here, if we scroll down a bit, somewhere here I'm drawing those horizontal bars right here, or rather vertical bars. What I'm doing is setting the fill style of the rendering context to red. That says from this point on, unless I specify otherwise, I want any filled figure that I draw filled with red. Red is just a string, which is a valid CSS color identifier. And then in this for loop, I'm calling a method named fillRect to draw those filled rectangles. Obviously, you're not limited to just rectangles. You can draw arbitrary paths, which are composed from lines, splines, and curves. If you look through this code, you'll see that how I draw all the horizontal and vertical lines is by defining a path that is a line and then applying ink to that path using a method named stroke. You may have also noticed that I rotated by 90 degrees the text on the y-axis of that chart. If you're curious to know how that's done, this rotate method, which I'm calling on the rendering context here, applies a rotate transform. If you've used rotate transforms in XAML before, you know that you can rotate any XAML element or any group of XAML elements by an arbitrary amount by applying a rotate transform to them. I'm doing the exact same thing here in HTML5's Canvas API. I'm rotating the entire coordinate system 270 degrees. So from that point on, until I reset the origin of the coordinate system and reset its angle, everything that I draw, whether it's text or anything else, will be rotated 270 degrees. Now, you can see what I mean when I said it's a rather primitive API. It's all immediate mode. You're making calls in a JavaScript to draw things, but there's a lot of power there as well, drawing text, drawing shapes, drawing drop shadows. You may have noticed the text at the top of the page had a drop shadow behind it, even applying transforms to make things rotate, scale, and translate. Let me show you another example really quickly. Here's a page that uses not one canvas, but 11 of them, and is another great example of the kind of application that simply would not have been possible before HTML5 came about. What you're looking at here is a page that has 11 canvases. Each one represents one piece of this puzzle with the sliding pieces in it. I've used the Canvas API to take a larger image, this mountain landscape that you see, and I've cut it up, drawing pieces of that larger image onto different canvases. Now, I can use CSS and jQuery if I want to animate those canvases and make them slide around. In fact, if I click these puzzle pieces, All I'm doing is using jQuery animations to slide the puzzle pieces around between HTML5's Canvas API, which allowed me to cut the image up to begin with, and jQuery's animation support. Something that would have been very difficult to build without those became relatively trivial, 30, 40 lines of code tops. And if you want to look at that code, I will allow you to take the time to do that yourself. Is there anything else here that we want to look at before we move on? Yeah, let me show you this really quickly. Just to point you to this, if you do choose to download this code and take a look, I've been asked on more than one occasion, does HTML5's Canvas API support layering? Well, the answer is no, not strictly speaking. But that doesn't mean that you can't take advantage of layering. That's what I'm doing here. What I've done here is taken two images and one canvas. I've stacked them on top of each other using CSS absolute positioning and also set their Z order. The element that's furthest away from your eye is the image that you see, the one with the skyline in the foreground, the mountains in the background. Closer to your eye, in fact closest, is a copy of that image with all of the pixels for the mountains removed. In other words, it's just an image of the skyline with a transparent background. I've placed a canvas in between the two. And I'm using canvas animations to rotate these spotlights, which are nothing more than partially transparent rectangles, back and forth. Now, what I'm doing is letting the browser do the complex clipping for me, since the skyline with the transparent background pixels, since that image lies in front of the canvas, the browser is doing the clipping to make it look like those skylights are behind the canvas. Now, you may wonder, in fact, I've been asked a time or two, how did I generate that image with the skyline? Well, the short answer is Photoshop. The longer answer is, do any of you have teenage daughters at home with boyfriends? I have a teenage daughter at home. In fact, I have two. My youngest one just became a teenager. My oldest one has a boyfriend, very nice young man, that she's very serious about. And the wonderful thing about having a daughter with boyfriends is that they will do anything you ask. So it turns out he's very good with Photoshop. So I called him over and said, I need a favor. Would you be willing to help me? And of course, he said, yes, sir, I'd be willing to help. So I gave him the image, and he did the work in Photoshop to generate that foreground image. I just say that because I didn't want to take credit for myself. It probably would have taken me forever to do it. Okay, what else do we have? I'd love to spend more time on the Canvas API, but our time is limited, so let's move on to the next one. Web workers. One of my favorite features of HTML5, one that in my experience developers tend to not know a lot about, and yet one that once you learn about might be one of the most important HTML5 features you ever come across. Web workers is multi-threading in JavaScript. Let me ask you this. Did you ever think the day would come when JavaScript developers could write true multi-threaded code? And is that a good thing? Does it scare you just a little bit? After all, writing multi-threaded code, writing concurrent code, is one of the hardest things a software developer will ever do. Not that it's hard to create threads. Anybody could do that. My daughter's boyfriend could do that. It's hard to synchronize those threads, to make sure that they work together, to make sure the two threads don't try to hit the same data structure at the same time, perhaps resulting in a corrupted data read. Well, let me ask you this. Because this is one area where I think the HTML5 committees were incredibly clever. What if we could give you an API that would allow you to do multi-threading, but it made it so idiot-proof that almost anyone could do it without messing up? What if we completely took away the need for any thread synchronization, but still gave you the power of multi-threading? Would that be attractive? That's exactly what this API does. It allows us to have JavaScript code execute on background threads. We never physically create a thread. We just create a web worker. Ultimately, it's up to the browser and the operating system how those web workers are mapped to physical threads. That way, even if a developer who doesn't know what they're doing tries to create 1,000 of these things to avoid bogging down the CPU, you may find that, in fact, only 4, 5, maybe 6 physical threads have been added to the process. But, indeed, the code will execute on a background thread. Now, before I show you an example, and you can see that I rate this pretty highly because they really have given us an ingenious API that gives us the benefits of multi-threading without all of the complexities. Before I do that, let me say just a word about why this might be interesting. There are two reasons web workers or multi-threaded JavaScript is interesting to an HTML5 developer. Number one, most devices that our code executes on these days have CPUs with multiple cores. Even my little Windows phone right here has a dual-core CPU. Some of the newer phones have quad-core CPUs. And you may know already the only way you can really leverage devices with multiple CPUs is to carve work up onto multiple threads so that those threads can execute concurrently on the different cores. So number one, Web Workers allows us to build applications that leverage the hardware that we're running them on today. Number two, it allows us to avoid long-running loops on the UI thread, perhaps rendering the application frozen to user input. The last thing you ever want to do in JavaScript or any other language for that matter is start a long-running loop on the UI thread, because if you prevent the browser or whoever is hosting your code from pumping messages, then it can't respond to user input. By taking that long-running work we're doing, computational work, for example, and putting it on a background thread, we do our number crunching back there, but we don't impede the UI thread's ability to continue pumping messages and responding to user input. So that doesn't mean that every HTML5 app needs web workers, but it's something that every HTML5 app and every HTML5 developer should be aware of. Now, let's take a look at web workers in action, in case you've never seen these before. And in fact, most of the examples I've seen out there in the wild aren't very realistic. They're trivial, that examples that use a background thread to count prime numbers or something like that. I wanted to come up with something a little bit more representative of what you might encounter in the real world. So I built this. Let's go into my workers folder. I'm going to call this thing multi-Mandelbrot. And actually, this one runs a little bit faster in Chrome, so I'm going to run it over there. Let's get it out of IE for the moment. This uses the Canvas API and the Web Workers API to render the most famous fractal in the world, the Mandelbrot set. And I can zoom in by clicking, so we'll click right there, and we'll zoom in. I see something interesting here, so I click again. Now, if you look quickly, and you do have to watch quickly, you'll see that this display isn't being painted all at once. Instead, it's appearing in quadrants. Let me click a couple of times again so that you can see that. Here's what I've done. The entire UI for this page is nothing more than an image. But it's not some canned image that's sitting out on a web server somewhere. Instead, I'm using the Canvas API to generate every pixel every time the user clicks to zoom in. You can imagine that that is quite CPU intensive. I'm doing tons of floating point math for each pixel on this display, and there are millions of them here. I have to go through a loop up to 128 times to determine what the proper color of that pixel is. To make that as fast as possible and to leverage the multiple cores present on this device I'm running on, it does have four cores, I wanted to carve that workup into four different threads so that the browser and the OS could elect to execute all of that computational work concurrently on four different threads. So I create four web workers in the app. I give each of them a signal to start running, passing it some information, telling it what quadrant of the display it's responsible for. It does all of the pixel computations for me and then posts a message back to the UI thread, which actually renders out all the pixels that the background thread computed. Let me show you really quickly what that looks like here in code. If you look in this page here, one of the first things I do is I use the Canvas API to create four image data objects. Now, in Canvas parlance, image data equals bitmap. An image data object is what most of us would refer to as a bitmap. These image data objects are empty. But it's on the background threads that I'm going to do the computations to fill them with pixels. So to create the up to four background threads, to create the four web workers, I new up the workers right here. Now you'll notice when I new up a worker, I pass it a URL of a JavaScript file. The browser does the same thing here that it does when it encounters a script element in a web page. If it hasn't downloaded that JavaScript file before, then it pulls it down through HTTP and caches it. If it has downloaded it before, then it pulls it right out of the browser cache. Regardless, the code in my scripts folder in the file name mandelbrot.js is the code that's doing all the computationally heavy work that's executing on a background thread. Then I register a handler for message events fired from each of these four workers. This is important. It turns out that one of the ways that they simplified this model, one of the ways they did away with any need for thread synchronization, is they made it virtually impossible for two threads to share data. When you think about it, if two threads can't share data, if they can't even share a simple var, then those two threads probably have zero need to synchronize their actions with one another. But there are some limitations that arise from that model. One is that a background thread can't touch the UI. In fact, a background thread, a worker, runs in a special context in which there is no window object and no document object. So I don't even have a way of getting a reference in a worker to a DOM element so I could update the UI. But the thread that created a worker can send messages to that thread by calling post message. And the worker, in turn, can call post message itself to send messages back to the thread that created it. So what I'm doing here is letting the workers do the computations. I'm passing them these image data objects. Then I simply sit back on the UI thread, waiting for the worker to say, okay, my image data object is ready. That means now that when one of these is ready, this will actually be called four times each time I click, once by each of the four workers I've launched. I reach in right here and grab the image data object back from the worker. This is the empty image data object I had created, but that the worker has now filled with pixels. And then I use the Canvas APIs, put image data here on the UI thread to draw those pixels. So what am I doing here? I'm building an application that is more responsive because it's not doing these long-running loops, the computational loops on a background thread. I'm better leveraging hardware with multiple cores. And all of a sudden, the logic on my UI thread becomes very simple. The heavy lifting is being done by the workers, the code executing on the background thread. And I just sit back and wait for them to message me and tell me that they're ready with the results I asked them to compute. This is a great example of web workers at work. Multi-threaded JavaScript. Wow. Now, as if that weren't thrilling enough, another major feature of HTML5 is something called web storage. Now, web storage gives us a way to store data persistently on the client. Think about this. In the old days, if you wanted to build a web app or a website that, say, prompted the user for a preferred language the first time they visit the site, you might have stored that data in a cookie. And you can still do that. Cookies still work in HTML5. But there are a lot of things we don't like about cookies. For example, cookies are limited in how much data they can hold, typically 4K. And it's a good thing they're limited, too, because as you probably know, once that cookie's issued, it now pollutes requests and responses. It travels back up in every request from that browser to the site that issued the cookie each time the request is made. That means, among other things, cookies aren't very secure either. Web storage gives us a way in HTML5 to take data, whether it's simple or much more complex, and store it on the client side without having to physically touch the file system. Now, I've given it a B. I thought about giving it an A. It works really, really well. But the reason I chose to give it a B is that it does come with one very frustrating limitation. And that is, you're limited in how much data you can store in web storage. You can imagine that the committees who design this feature and the browser vendors are a little bit worried about allowing web apps to store data on the client side, because if that data were unlimited in volume, someone could write a malicious application that simply filled the user's hard disk with data. Because at the end of the day, browsers are taking what you write to web storage and they're storing it in some file in a secret directory on the hard disk. By the way, where they store it is different for every browser. That's another reason I gave this a B. You can't write something to web storage in Chrome and read it from IE or vice versa. This specification tells the browser vendors what the API has to look like, but it doesn't tell them how or where to physically store the data. But that 5 megabyte limitation, it's roughly 5 megabytes, it actually varies some in some browsers, means you're never guaranteed that what you write to web storage is going to work. In fact, at any time, you can get an exception telling you that your quota has been exceeded. And I know from personal experience, that has turned out to be a big stumbling block to a lot of teams who are seriously considering HTML5 for their next project. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't ways to store larger amounts of data on the client side in an HTML5 app. In fact, I'm going to talk about one alternative way on the next slide, but it does mean that we have to be cognizant of the fact that we have a limited data store here in terms of the volume that we can write to it. What I would have liked to have seen the committees done is compel or at least recommend to the browser vendors that they make this configurable, or that they allow the user to decide on an app-by-app basis whether more data can be written to web storage. Some browsers do support that, by the way, but only with browser-specific APIs, and those don't really interest us because the whole point of using HTML5 is to find something that works in every different browser. Here's a quick look at what web storage looks like if you've never seen this before. I'm going to go into my storage folder and run something called Storage Scribble right here. And here's what Storage Scribble looks like when you run it. I'm using the Canvas API to allow the user to doodle on this chalkboard here. I double-clicked it to clear it off. And now I'll just take the mouse and I'll do something like that. You can see I can scribble around. All I'm doing canvas-wise, by the way, is drawing a line onto this canvas for each mouse movement that's reported. I'm simply connecting XY coordinate pairs with lines. But where storage comes in is, as the user draws, I record what they've written into web storage so that if they close down that browser, shut their machine down, go take a vacation in Hawaii or something for a week or a year, and they come back, they fire that application up, and all the data is still there. Oops, let's get it to the right page, and let's try that again, and all the data is still there. Fingers crossed, and there it is. So let me show you really quickly what the API behind web storage looks like. It's fairly simple. By the way, there are two different types of web storage. There is local storage and session storage. The APIs are almost the same. When most people refer to web storage, they're actually referring to local storage because it's local storage that is persistent. Session storage is not persistent. You generally use it when you just want to share data in memory among multiple pages within your application. I'm using local storage here because I want it to be persistent. And here's what the code looks like in Storage Scribble. If we go down and look at my mouse handling logic, here in onMouseUp, this signifies the left mouse button has been released. It's the end of a stroke that the user has drawn. And to persist that stroke, that is all the XY coordinate pairs that define it, I call a local helper function named storeStroke. And if you look in storeStroke, you'll see that what I do is I take an array of an arrays. It's an array of arrays of XY coordinate pairs. I stringify them using the browser's json.stringify method. That's present, by the way, in every HTML5 browser in the world. And I write it to local storage right here. You access local storage through the local storage property of the window object. Notice that I'm keying it with the string value. Local storage is presented to you as a dictionary. You can write anything into that dictionary you want. It has to be keyed by a string. If you later want to retrieve the data, as I do when the app starts up to read the stroke data back and recreate the strokes, then you simply specify that same key. One thing to be aware of, however, and another reason I didn't give this an A grade, is that while you can write any type of data into local storage, it is always stringified when it's recorded, so it always comes back to you as a string. If you write, say, a number, a JavaScript number, into local storage, when it comes back, you get a string, and you have to coerce it back to its original type. You can partially abstract that by using JSON as your storage format, as I'm doing right here. I won't go through the code that actually reloads this when the browser starts, but if you want to look at it yourself, it's up here near the top, and all we're doing is proving that, yes, we can persist data with web storage. Now, again, probably the chief complaint about web storage is that it doesn't allow us to store unlimited amounts of data. It would not be appropriate for trying to cache images and things like that because most browsers impose a 5 megabyte limitation or thereabouts. That's also a shared quota, by the way. By shared quota, I mean this. That 5 megabyte nominal quota applies not only to your app, but to all other apps that share the same origin yours do. Now, what does origin mean? Origin is very strictly defined in HTML5. It's a combination of protocol, like HTTP, host, like www.microsoft.com, and the port number. If you're a big company like Microsoft, you may have thousands of HTML5 pages at www.microsoft.com, all that rely on web storage to one extent or another. It's not that each of those pages, each of those apps, has 5 megabytes of storage. It's that all of them together have only 5 megabytes. Now, what I do, Whenever I write to local storage, I make sure I wrap that in a try-catch block. If an exception is thrown, telling me that I've exceeded my quota, I call localstorage.clear, which wipes out everything anyone else has written. That's not necessarily a friendly thing to do, but it does work. You didn't hear about that here. But there is something else you can do. There's another way to store data persistently on the client in HTML5. You can see that this isn't supported in every browser yet, because it is a relatively new feature. It's called IndexedDB. It solves two problems with web storage. One, it gives you access to potentially unlimited amounts of storage. Different browser vendors so far are taking different tacks, but in IE, for example, they'll allow you to write up to 10 megabytes worth of data to an IndexedDB, but prompt the user to give you access to more storage if you want it and need it. Other browser vendors are taking a similar tack. So in theory, we could use this to cache much larger data sets and objects than we could with web storage. The other thing that's nice about IndexedDB is that it at least does give us a way to store more structured data. Web storage is basically just a dictionary of key value pairs. If you want to add structure to the data, it's up to you to do that. With IndexedDB, we have real database-like storage. Now, you'll see that despite that, I didn't give this an A, and let me tell you why. IndexedDB is a fairly recent addition to the HTML5 family. Before there was IndexedDB, there was something called the WebSQL database. In fact, the WebSQL database spec still lives out on the W3C's website, but if you go to it and read it, there's a big red block at the top of the page that says, "Do not use this API." It is officially deprecated. You see, it turns out that the different folks involved in the definition of WebSQL database could not agree on which dialect of SQL to use. So at the end of the day, they threw up their hands, they walked away from the table and said, "Sorry, there will be no client-side database in HTML5. Another group of folks said, "You know what, that's crazy." So they gave us IndexedDB. Now, IndexedDB does give us database-like storage, but it's not relational storage. It is an object database. You can create an IndexedDB. You can create multiple object stores inside it. You can write to those object stores. You can read. You have some querying capability, but the querying capability is very limited. It does support indexing of object stores, which is nice. That's why it's called IndexedDB, so that if you are storing large amounts of records or objects in a given object store, maybe hundreds of thousands, even millions of them, by indexing fields in those object stores, you can retrieve objects very, very quickly, giving you the same kind of functionality you have in indexes on relational tables in SQL. Now, there aren't a lot of examples of IndexedDB out there today. Let me just show you really quickly an example that I put together so you can look at if you want on your own time. And it is this one. Let's go up to my IndexedDB folder. Like full-scale pilots, RC jet pilots log and record all their flights. And it's not just because we want to be cool. It's because if you track certain things like exhaust gas temperature coming from your jet engine, max fuel pump voltage, and things like that, you can actually recognize trouble before it becomes catastrophic and perhaps costs you a lot of time and a lot of money when that jet just blows up in the air. So I used to track this stuff in an Excel spreadsheet. Now I do it on an app I've written for my Windows phone, and I'm in the process of developing a logbook written in HTML5, which will be device independent, and which will use the Canvas API to draw pretty charts and graphs and things like that. But this version of it, which is a small piece of it, does use IndexedDB to store information about these things. Basically, each of these rows here is an object. It represents one flight of one jet. When the app is first started up, I create the database if it doesn't already exist. I seed it with some flights. I provide an add flight dialog so you can add additional flights if you want. And I provide some filtering capability in that I do the equivalent of a select distinct query using the IndexedDB API and dynamically create these HTML buttons at the top representing the different jets in the database. If I click one of them, I then do a query on that object store and show only those flights that pertain to that particular jet. Now, I wish I had 30 minutes to go through the API. It's a little unusual the first time you see it, but again, it's all here in these samples if you want to take a look at it. Now, we have about 10 minutes left, so let's do this. I want to skip on to a couple of features that I think are incredibly important, and if we have time, I'll come back and hit a couple of these that I skipped over. XML HTTP request level 2. Notice the grade here, a big fat A. XML HTTP request level 2 is AJAX version 2. AJAX has been around for many years now, since the late 90s. By the way, here's a trivia question for you. What company invented AJAX? Does anyone know? Microsoft, exactly. It's amazing how many people don't know that. We're the company that doesn't innovate, right? Well, we invented AJAX. Put that in your pipe and smoke it, huh? But despite the fact that AJAX is so fundamentally important to web apps today, there's so many ways that it could be improved. And it's interesting, with XML HTTP request level 2, they have taken almost everything we could possibly want to do to make AJAX better, and they have added it in. Somebody yell out here, what's the number one limitation of AJAX today? Inability to go cross-domain, right? Wouldn't it be nice if we could go cross-domain? Guess what? You can now with XML HTTP request level 2. How about this? Have you ever used AJAX to build a file upload UI and seen how difficult it is to provide some kind of progress UI to the user showing the progress of the upload? How about if we retooled XML HTTP request so that now it fires progress events as that upload takes place? Wouldn't that be cool? Well, that's exactly what they've done. How about this? XML HTTP request was originally built to transmit text data and nothing else, meaning if we wanted to transmit binary data, we had to jump through hoops to do it. What if we rewired this thing so that it handles binary data as well as text data? Would that be appealing? Well, that's another thing they've done in XML HTTP request level 2. Again, almost everything that was wrong with AJAX, they have fixed it. And it's amazing. Let me show you an example here. One of the few examples in the world that I know of an actual cross-domain call going out from a browser. This is going to go out to a web server back home, showing that we can now go cross-domain with AJAX. By the way, let me mention this. You cannot just walk up to any old server anywhere in the world and make a call via AJAX from an HTML5 browser and expect it to work if the call is cross-domain. If you're a Flash developer or Silverlight developer, you know that in those environments, we have to add policy files to the server, providing permission for those cross-domain calls to take place. It's similar here. We have to have the server be complicit in the call. It has to give the browser permission to do the cross-domain call. And the way they elected to provide that permission is not through Flash or Silverlight-like policy files, but through a header-based protocol called CORS, Cross-Origin Resource Sharing. The reason I'm calling back home to a service that I wrote is that I wrote it in WCF, and I implemented the server half of that CORS protocol in it. If you care to see the source code, I included it in this Visual Studio project. But let's see if this actually works here. I'm going to go into my networking folder and pull up a little demo called XHR2 Cross-Domain Demo. And we're going to attempt to make an honest-to-goodness cross-domain call to a server back in the U.S. What this does is it lets me type in a U.S. zip code. This is where I live, just outside the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. I'll call Get Current Weather, and look at that, cross-domain. You can look at the URL in the code. You can see that it is an absolute URL. You can see that it's going cross-domain. This would not have been possible with AJAX level 1. Again, I had to implement the CORS protocol on the service back home to allow it to work. If you look at the code, it was just a few lines of code. It wasn't hard to do. Number one complaint about AJAX not being able to go cross-domain now addressed, as well as lots of other issues being addressed. That's why I graded that an A. Something else I graded an A as well. Another big piece of news when it comes to networking in HTML5 is something called WebSockets. If you haven't heard about WebSockets yet, you probably will. Some people feel that this is the most important enhancement to networking since the introduction of HTTP itself several years ago. In fact, even though this was invented by HTML5, you now see other platforms, native platforms like Windows 8, providing WebSocket support. What are WebSockets? In a word, HTTP is a pull protocol. For years, we've had it. We can fire a request from a browser up to a server. We can pull data down. But what if we want to update that data in real time? What if it's stock prices, sports scores, or something like that? We've never had a standard way to go from the server back to the browser asynchronously anytime we want with data, meaning if we wanted to build real-time apps, we had to resort to polling, to comment, or something like that. WebSockets allow us to establish a two-way TCP duplex connection between a browser and a web server over HTTP using an HTTP handshake, and then to use the connection through the same port that the HTTP communications or conversation took place with as a duplex socket. It's friendly to firewalls. It's friendly to proxy servers. It's been specifically designed to do that. And I want to show you one example of WebSockets at work. If you wanted to build, for example, a chat client, a real-time chat client in HTML5, you could do that today without even any hint of polling. Let's see if it works. After all, I could just be telling you this, making it all up. If I don't show it to you, you should be suspicious of everything that I say. So what I'm going to do is run two apps here, actually run two instances of the same app. Let's go back to my networking folder, websocket-scribble.html. I'm going to run one in IE, and this is one of the few ways that HTML5 allows you to actually go cross-browser type with your communications. What these two apps are doing when they start up is they are establishing a two-way connection to a WebSocket server that I wrote using .NET 4.5. If you didn't know already, WebSocket servers are not the easiest things in the world to write, but .NET 4.5, which ships with Windows 8, has a new networking namespace named windows.networking.websockets, which makes it relatively easy to write WebSocket servers. If you're curious to see what one looks like, I included that code as well in this Visual Studio solution. Now, these apps, once they establish that WebSocket connection, each time I draw in one of them, it JSON encodes all the stroke data, transmits it up to the WebSocket server, which turns around and broadcasts it out to all the other apps that are connected. So if this works, I should be able to draw in one of these browsers, and I should see what I draw appear in the other. How about that? Now, you imagine that that's a chat client or one that shows stock prices in semi-real time or something like that. We finally have a model in the HTML world for pushing data down from that server anytime we want, as opposed to just making a call and pushing data up or requesting that the data came down. WebSockets, a big A. Networking, very, very well done in HTML5. Now, there are a couple of things that I didn't cover. They were lesser important things, file APIs. Let me tell you this. I skipped over the slide that gave the one really bad grade. There are actually three file-related specifications in HTML5. One is called the file API spec. It defines something called a file reader that lets you read from files on a hard disk, provided the user offers you those files, generally through an open file dialog. You cannot in HTML5 simply build an app that goes out and rummages the user's hard disk for files and reads data from them, and that's probably a good thing. Probably the biggest hole, however, in HTML5 today is that while there is now finally a file writer API, it's one of the other three. Only one browser implements it so far, that is Chrome, and Chrome doesn't map it to the physical file system. It only maps it to a virtual file system. So while it's possible to read files from the hard disk in HTML5 today, it's not yet possible to write to them. There are browser-specific APIs that allow that, but no HTML5 APIs yet. At some point, probably sooner rather than later, a browser vendor will get brave enough to map the file writer and file system APIs to the physical file system, and then we'll be able to write to files as well as read from them. And with that, our time is up. I hope you learned something here. I hope it's been helpful, and I'll see you at a session later in the conference. Thank you.